Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Today, we're looking at trends in nutraceuticals. For the past few years, nutraceuticals have been a wild success story. Whatever customers have been looking for, there have been teams of researchers, product developers, and marketers working to supply it, bringing new products to aid gut health, sleep, mood, immunity, sports performance, and so on. During the pandemic, when we've all been more focused on health than normal, the sector continued to innovate. As we move into a time where the world is now opening up, where we perhaps have a different perspective on our personal and collective health, we thought we'd ask this. Which areas in nutraceuticals are seeing the most demand? And it's a question worth asking because nutraceuticals is now big, big business, and the people who can spot consumer trends and shifts in the market will flourish. With me are the two perfect panellists to chat this through. We have Mike Hughes, Head of Research and Insight at the market research organisation FMCG Gurus. He's got vast experience in analysing consumer trends, attitudes and behaviours. Hello there, Mike.
Hi there. Thank you, Stefan.
Great to have you. We've also got Chris Newbold, who's Head of Nutrition Strategy at BioCare, a natural healthcare company which serves the public and practitioners throughout the UK. Hello there, Chris.
Hi there.
It's great to have you both with us. Right, Chris, let's just start off with a really simple one. For anyone who's been hiding under a rock, how do you define a nutraceutical?
It's essentially a nutrition product like food, but based on a food essentially or food extract, and that we know to have a specific health effect. Sometimes can be dose form, in which case we might call it supplements, and sometimes it can be in food form, in which case we'll call it a functional food. But it could be a botanical, a plant extract, a specific vitamin, it could be bacteria, it could be a particular enzyme. And obviously it contrasts with a pharmaceutical, which is where that term comes from. Pharmaceutical arguably being a bit more chemical, a bit more specific, and also a licensed medicine. So we're using essentially a natural foodstuff or a property of a natural foodstuff, knowing its health effect and using it in greater quantities or concentrations in a specific way. So more measured, more targeted than a food.
So in some ways, it's a sort of a hinterland between food and medicine. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's right. As I say, we have to be careful not to say it has medical effects, but certainly we're very aware that certain foods, certain ingredients have health effects, obviously, and using them in a certain balance or a combination has a certain known effect. So we're using that scientific knowledge and property of food, modifying it, as you say, towards a kind of pharmaceutical type product, and then producing it as a nutraceutical.
Good stuff. Okay. So, Mike, I mentioned that this is big business now. Can you give us an overview of the nutraceuticals market? Globally, you know, what growth have we seen and whereabouts in the world has it been growing more than others?
Well, there's a short-term answer and a more complex answer. So the very short-term answer is it's growing significantly. The more complex answer is when we get asked to size up the nutraceutical market, we always think this is a real nightmare because, you know, a nutraceutical is something that can be defined in a variety of different ways. As Chris says, it could be sports nutrition products, it could be fermented products, it could be fortified products, it could be medical nutrition, it could be functional food and drinks, it could actually just be everyday food and drink that's high in certain ingredients. You've also got products that have the direct health claims, and you may also have products where consumers don't actually look for health claims, but they already associate that ingredient or that food products with having a benefit. So it's a really wide scope. And outside of those few countries where there's a really stringent legislation on definition, it's very hard to quantify. So in the short term, it's worth billions and billions. It encompasses everything. Some of the key areas where we've seen it grow is Asia Pacific. One of the things that we've seen that's been really interesting over the last couple of years is consumers are still conscious about COVID-19. For absolute sure, but in North America and in Europe, you know, that fear seems to have resided a little. You know, consumers have learned to live with the virus, and as a result, whilst they're still being significantly more health conscious than they were in 2019, that initial fear that we saw in perhaps 2020 isn't quite there. The actual opposite is the case in Asia Pacific, where consumers are still very, very conscious about things such as germs, viruses, bacteria. It will be driven by a culture that, you know, even before pandemic mask wearing was common. So we're seeing these areas in terms of generations, they're proving popular amongst consumers of all ages. You know, consumers are looking to long-term health for a variety of reasons. Again, when we looked at our research around COVID-19, what we saw was there wasn't necessarily a straight line trend between the older you got, the more conscious about COVID-19 you were, even though, you know, if you looked at the death rates, it followed a very clear pattern. The reason for that was consumers of all ages were reevaluating their health and going, actually, you know what, perhaps one of the reasons I was so concerned about my vulnerability to this was my diet and my lifestyle is not as healthy as it should be. And actually, even if I'm not at risk of COVID-19 immediately, there's actually other long-term health problems that I may be conscious of, and my diet and lifestyle is attributing to that. So you have the older consumers who are very much focused on, you know, health maintenance for there and then. You know, they want to stave off the threat of disease and illness and maintain a good quality of life. But it's something that you're also seeing in younger consumers, such as Generation Z and millennials. They're significantly changing their snacking habits to seek out functional products. They're actively seeking out health claims. And again, it's that focus on actually perhaps our diets and lifestyle aren't as healthy as they should be. So as a result of that, you know, I'm gonna seek out these products. So we're seeing massive growth in health and wellness products across the market at the moment. And that is something that will continue for the foreseeable future. One, because, you know, we're not out of the woods with COVID-19, and what happens in the winter will really define what happens in the next 5 years with waves of the virus. But also, you know, consumers are still very much focused on disease management and prevention over cure and fear of illness. And this is something that will continue to drive the nutraceutical market for many years.
So, Chris, as Mike said, you've got these double problems. First of all, how do you define a nutraceutical? And secondly, are we in the middle of flux that is so unusual that it's impossible to spot a trend or a particular market? Is that the case for you? I mean, we've been in a pandemic. You know, people have been focused in a very, very different way on health, nutrition and lifestyle. Despite all the chaos, are you still spotting trends, consumer trends and health trends?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's some things that aren't predictable, a bit like Mike said, and maybe took us by surprise. I think there's certainly been that increased interest. So people are looking at what was, as Mike said, wrong with them before, you could say, what was difficult about their lifestyles. There's a lot more awareness and education going on. I think there's a lot more self-education. People, I mean, this was a situation where, in a sense, there wasn't a medical solution to a huge problem. So I think people took a lot more responsibility for finding things out. And so I think to some extent, the trends were affected by the chat in social, some of the media stories. So we tended to see high vitamin C, for example, at the beginning, and then it morphed into vitamin D, and then it morphed into quercetin. So there seemed to be this kind of chat out there in media terms and social media terms that was dictating it, and what people were finding out and what people were talking about between their particular social media groups. So to some extent, we were riding the wave of that. We were at the sort of rear end of that, just reacting. But the commonalities, I think, that came through was wanting to self-educate, having more time to think during lockdowns. And I think it went two ways for people. Some people became even more health aware and started to make changes and wanted to look at their personalized health. And also, to some extent, I think a dynamic that's still there was that for some people, it actually got a lot worse as well. And they kind of locked themselves in, literally. They changed their diets. They got takeaways. They watched a lot more TV. Eventually, as it got colder, the 1 hour a day of exercise kind of dried up. Alcohol consumption, I think, and drug consumption's probably increased as people try to cope with this artificial situation. So I think there's been this weird dichotomy that's come out of it, of increased health awareness, increased responsibility for health. But also, I think there have been some, for a lot of people, some really profound long-term habit changes in our culture. But the positives that came out, in a way, was that interest in health, that drive towards looking at, well, what does it mean for me? What do I need for me and my family to protect myself? The long COVID type issues that have come out have meant that people are looking at broader health issues now, like gut health, hormonal health, their energy levels, their cell energy, whether they've got chronic fatigue type problems. And they're taking more responsibility, I think, for the most part. I think the other thing that changed as well, which is an interesting dynamic in the industry, is we're all so familiar now with self-testing at home. And that's an interesting change that I've seen, is that I think people want to know, beyond the information they can get from their GP, which is of course important, what else do I not know about myself in terms of my genetics, maybe in terms of how my cells produce energy? So there's been this increasing trend towards personal health testing as well. And I think in a sense, the whole COVID testing regime that we've all been under of self-testing, swabbing, you know, every day sometimes, has desensitized us to that and made people much more open to the idea that they can take responsibility and test their own health and figure out what solutions they might need.
And that's a really interesting shift, isn't it? Okay, so Mike, I accept that it's a tricky area. Within this area, what patterns do we still manage to spot? I mean, demographic divisions, is there a generational divide? Is it men and women, geographical divide? Can you spot any trends in those kind of areas?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I absolutely agree with Chris, and I think, you know, the issue of self-education and greater responsibility is something that is influencing consumer health. And we're definitely seeing consumers take a more proactive approach now. You know, over the last 2 years, consumers were subject to so much information about, you know, mortality rates, R rates, how viruses are spread. They were panicked by that. And that panic doesn't just go away because the food service sector reopened. So you see consumers now who, for instance, will go on a tube and they'll grab a rail and they'll be immediately conscious about what they might have on their hands, where 3 years ago they might not have done that. They're being more attentive now to the ingredients in products, again, because we've had time to think about these things. And as a result of this, we've seen a definite pattern towards immune-boosting health products. You know, what I used to say about the health and wellness market, you know, prior to COVID-19 was it was somewhat aspirational. It tended to be driven by younger consumers who, it was still very much focused on weight management. It was very short-term focused, and consumers would try and lead a healthier lifestyle. When that didn't work, and often we saw the prevalence of lifestyle-related health problems growing so often it didn't work, they'd go, okay, that's fair enough. Perhaps here's not the right time. I'll revisit in 6 months. What you see now is a greater urgency and consumers saying, I need to sort my health out now. So what they're looking for is, and I say one thing that's come as a trend is two things. One, immune health products have been growing in popularity. You know, beforehand it might have been weight loss products, but definitely immunity. And also what we're seeing is, as well, from younger and older consumers, is consumers definitely want multifunctional products. You know, gone are the days where consumers may have gone, okay, this product's high in vitamin C, this product's high in vitamin D, I kind of associate this product with benefit in joint and bone, or this with heart health. Instead, they want a product that they can believe in, where they say this has got ingredient A, B and C, and as a result, it helps address this area of my physical health, my cognitive health, my emotional well-being. You know, those products are associated with maximum efficacy. They're associated with maximum convenience because, you know, even in a time of the pandemic, you know, consumers can struggle to stick to health routines. As Chris mentioned, you know, sometimes exercise rates can dwindle. You know, consumers may feel a bit stressed or busy and struggle to stick to a healthy diet. So as a result of this, they want these multifunctional claims. And that's what we're really seeing at the moment, a move towards products around immunity, also digestive health. And that's something that will only continue to grow as more people become known about the gut microbiome and the link it can have on these illnesses. Mm. And I've heard things from scientists, and I don't know how accurate it is, but in 10 years' time, you know, babies will be sampled for their gut microbiome very early, you know, and you can develop personalized products around that because of their vulnerability to illness. But multifunctionality is everything, and that's the key trend at the moment. You've got younger and older consumers who are both driving that, but with very much different need states. Older consumers thinking here and now, actually, you know, this has shown that actually my health can deteriorate very rapidly. So I need these functional products to maintain health now. But then also, you know, you're definitely seeing a change in the mindset of younger people, who kind of realized how unhealthy their lifestyle was before. And I think that's a key reason sometimes when you see people who still want to work from home, even as COVID-19 has dwindled, because they've gone, actually, I don't want to go back to that lifestyle again because it was unhealthy. So again, you've got two different consumers who are driving it.
And another influence on a lot of the food sector has been sustainability, and consumers are caring more and more about sustainability within the products that they buy. And I wondered, Mike, do you think that this has an impact in the nutraceuticals sector? Has it led to more innovation and different R&D or supply chain changes, or is the sort of nutraceutical industry slightly kind of removed from that because it's so specific and it's often about things like supplements?
No, I don't think it is. And what, you know, the state of the environment is a massive concern for consumers. They feel that damage done is irreversible. They think that has a direct impact on their health. COVID-19 is something that intensified those concerns, you know, like was things such as overcrowding, the state of the environment, you know, air quality, something that contributed to the kind of widespread destruction of the environment. And as a result of this, you know, consumers wanted brands to act in a green and clean manner, to demonstrate initiatives along the whole of the supply chain as they sought out brands that they felt replicated their attitude and outlook on life. And this is something that's really important for the nutraceutical industry, because sometimes when you ask consumers, do you turn to nutritional supplements, do you turn to functional foods, etc., or do you find fortified food appealing, for instance? And they say no. One of the reasons is it sounds chemical. So they're like, you know, this product might have this, this, and this benefit, but actually I'm concerned about risks of side effects. I'm concerned about if it's got high doses of ingredients. You know, consumers are more risk averse than ever before. And the last thing that they want to do is pick up a product label and say, actually, there's six or seven ingredients on there that I just don't recognize. And they sound chemical. And, you know, chemical ingredients are associated with not being sustainable. So consumers want green and clean products. And there's two reasons for that. One, they're concerned about the environment in themselves. But two, they're also concerned about less sustainable practices, the influence they have on their health. It's a reason why, you know, plant-based ingredients continue to grow in popularity. We're seeing a lot of interest in botanical extracts at the moment. The reason consumers like botanical extracts is, hey, they're associated with boosting immunity, great, cognitive health, great. They're also natural and they're not damaging the planet. That's a win-win. So gone are the days where the functional industry could rely purely on science and technology and, you know, claims around efficacy to maintain and grow, you know, market size, irrespective of what type of industry you're in. What we're seeing now is brands also need to demonstrate green and green credentials, and that creates new levels of opportunity as well. You know, brands need to offset their carbon footprint. There's a greater interest in, say, botanical extracts. There's also opportunities that exist around upcycling, you know, take those ingredients, you know. And I was reading something really interesting the other day, for instance, about a company that were brewing beer, and they were wasting quite a bit of grain. And they were like, actually, we should do something with this grain. And it turned out that actually this grain was really high in probiotic fiber. And as a result of that, you know, they were able to take this ingredient and position it around being sustainable, but also, you know, functional. And that's something that the market definitely has to do to emphasize feelings of trust amongst consumers.
Yeah, absolutely. And Chris, I mean, I don't want to sound too obsessed with the shallowness of trends, but I mean, one of the really, really important drivers has been gut health and prebiotics and probiotics. Is that still one of the most important sectors of nutraceuticals, or are there, you know, are people beginning to get interested in other areas of physiology?
Yeah, it's still really important, and I think the whole COVID situation and other things to do with modern diet and lifestyle make it really important. People are very conscious of it. Gut problems are one of the key problems that you'll probably go to your GP about, gut and energy problems in terms of those kinds of conditions. So it is very important, but we've always been interested in all the other systems as well. And I think, again, you know, based on what Mike just said, there's interest across. I mean, mental health, for example, which I know we might talk about, is an absolutely massive driver that's come through in recent years, as if it weren't anyway. So gut is vitally important. I think what's different and interesting about gut recently in the context of all of those other body systems that we can use nutraceuticals for is that there's that understanding now that the gut microbiome is a significant contributor to some of those enzymes, proteins that support our health. I think with Tim Spector and some of those other people out there commentating on it and in, you know, in conventional sort of media and conventional circles, there's an increasing awareness that we have this kind of invisible organ in our body, which is the gut microbiome that we've evolved with. And the interesting thing about that is that our bodies have got used to the idea that these bacteria will produce certain chemicals for us. As a simple example, they'll contribute greatly to how well you digest and ferment the foods that you eat. So if you take them away, immediately your digestion and absorption is impaired. The big subject today is immunity as well. And so there's a massive role that those bacteria play in stimulating an appropriate response from the immune system. So we're used to them being there, although they've been an invisible organ and an organ we don't understand, but we should see them as an extra organ. So that's an interesting point where supporting gut health, even if gut isn't your primary problem, actually helps all the other systems around the body, cholesterol balance, triglyceride balance, hormone balance, detoxification, mental health. But also our other body systems affect the gut, and it's our nervous system that's having a huge impact on a lot of gut problems at the moment as well. It's our hormonal balance, for example. It's our immune system. So we do need to look at everything together. And I think the key trend for me that's coming up is personalized health in the context of what we've been saying. I think it's about understanding those products that Mike described, and the complexes, he's absolutely right. I think that the move is towards complexes of products, combinations of products that have been specifically designed and that you can trust, that have been designed with the right ideas in mind and that match your particular requirements, whether they're self-identified requirements, which is fairly important and accurate, or even people are delving deeper and they're testing their gut microbiome, which we've talked about, testing their vitamin D levels, testing their genetics, looking at what their genetic profile is and what their strengths and weaknesses might be, and looking for that. So information for me is absolutely key, and education, and aligning the product with the advice. Interesting what Mike said earlier about the types of ingredients, moving more towards botanicals and plants, and I agree with that. I think the challenge is that sometimes those botanical and natural and food form ingredients are actually the more expensive and the less sustainable ones, although I totally appreciate that's not the consumer perception. But it's very hard to get a level of vitamin C as a natural source, for example. It's not necessarily very good for the environment. So I think it's about getting that balance right and giving people the information about what's in the product. And obviously there's only a level to which they'll take that information on board. I think that's important. You know, some people are going to want to look at the science and the information more than others. So also there's a trust issue, I think, with companies of knowing that you are doing the right thing and formulating those products in the right way based on the people that you've got working for you. Because I think we need to get that balance right between the botanicals, the vitamins, the minerals, the probiotics, in order to make sure that the products are effective, that they're personal, and also that they are sustainable and they're ticking all those boxes for consumers.
There's a lot going on there. There's a lot of different things to think about. And I think what's interesting for me, Chris, is what Mike said about the, you know, the desire for multifunctional products. Now, presumably, the more multifunctional your product is, the more you delve into a web of regulatory difficulty where health claims are more difficult to extract because of the rules around them. I mean, when it comes especially to things like mental health and claims that include lots of different things, gut health and mental health, surely that must get very difficult for companies to navigate.
Absolutely. And the thing that was mentioned earlier about, to some extent, I think with knowledgeable consumers, and if we can support people's knowledge about the ingredients rather than the supplements, that's one way forward until things change from a regulatory point of view, which I hope at some point they will, so that we can have this middle way where something doesn't have to be a medicine for us to be able to say that it has a particular health effect, as long as we can justify that, of course. No one wants to have completely false claims, but there might be a different level of proof, but we're probably a long way off that if that ever happens. So in the meantime, we're reliant on the health claims that we can use, and happily, there are health claims for things like mental health. So wherever possible, we're always going to look to use ingredients, as long as they're appropriate, of course, that enables us to flag more easily to the consumer what this product is for. There's actually virtually no health claims for gut, so that presents an immediate problem for us. So you are relying a little bit more on general consumer knowledge in the first instance of a probiotic. I mean, we can't even use the word probiotic at the moment in terms of labelling. That's a heated discussion because it implies a health claim that's not been proven as far as EFSA is concerned. So we all know that everybody out there practically, especially if they've got any knowledge of this sector of the industry, understands what a probiotic is, and the word is completely meaningful for them. So to some extent, I think we're dependent upon, but we can also support consumers in understanding these things. And I think the important thing is it's away from the products, the sales and the marketing. And I think that's where we need to move towards, is giving people this information as an industry so that they can make those choices. Because, yeah, the legislative environment for companies is very challenging.
Yeah. And especially when it comes to really specific concepts like helping or supporting mental health. I mean, Mike, do you see the mental health, that there's a demand and there are products and consumer interest in mental health specifically? And if so, what's the nature of that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, we know that, you know, consumers are becoming more conscious about their mental health than ever before. We know in regions where, you know, historically discussing it was seen as something of a social taboo, that's kind of lifted, and there's a lot more openness. And, you know, even before the pandemic, you know, stress was common, anxiety was common, poor sleep health was common. The pandemic came along and just intensified that, and consumers had more worries than ever before, you know, and that's something that hasn't gone away. Consumers are concerned about, you know, whether life will fully return to normal, how long the virus will last for. You know, once the pandemic was passed, the economic crisis that many people were predicting, and at one stage it looked like it might not be as bad as it's thought, and then it's looking like next year it might be terrible, it might be worse than what was thought. So, you know, consumers are like really worried about a lot of things. And at the same time, consumers recognize that poor mental well-being isn't just, you know, doesn't just influence happiness, energy levels, mood. You know, it's not like I just feel a bit run down today, I can't really be bothered doing things. Consumers recognize that actually, if you're run down, if you're fatigued, if your emotional well-being is low, it actually has a direct impact on your immune system, and you're kind of more vulnerable to disease and illness, you know, because your body's not functioning properly. So consumers are taking a greater interest in the topic than ever before. As I said, social taboos are being lifted. You know, there's demographic groups like younger people, males who previously may not have been as open about it, who were driving it. And as a result, you know, the products are there. Now, Chris was exactly right with what you said. You know, consumers kind of want products that offer a variety of benefits. So they'll want this product that not only boosts my immune health, but helps me sleep better, helps me relax, helps me aid stress. So they want products that offer everything. But then at the same time, they're conscious about products that seem a magic bullet health solution, because they can be skeptical of the claims. So they want claims for everything, but then they can be skeptical when they see the claims for everything. You either, you know, use the clinically proven science-led evidence, which can be very difficult, especially with, you know, I'm not too familiar with how much legislation on mental well-being claims, but I know there's not that, you know, that many claims that can be made. Or you let consumers make the mind up on their own. And that goes back to, again, what Chris said about the self-education and researching, and consumers saying, well, actually, I associate these ingredients with addressing this. I associate these ingredients with helping me sleep better, you know, with making me feel more relaxed, with making me feel more happy. But this is such a big area, you know, and something that's been impacted so much. And again, we'll see that next year. You know, we was looking at some research recently, and many consumers at the moment are not satisfied with their financial well-being. They're struggling with everyday living costs. They have minimum savings. There was some research I saw the other day that was quite startling about the average household in the UK has around £500 savings, which means that if things go wrong, they feel the impact very, very quickly. This is going to be such a big area over the next 18 to 24 months, where consumers are struggling to survive on a day-by-day basis, and the emotional turmoil from that. Consumers will be impacted about what the immediate implications of this will be, but also the long term. And, you know, mental well-being will be such a big area. So you even need to launch products that are supported with the science to target, or launch those products and hope that actually consumers can make that link. This is a botanical, you know, like rose, chamomile, etc., something like that. Consumers are likely to associate it with sleep, even if you can't necessarily make certain claims on products directly.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's cover a couple of real specifics now. Now, nootropics is a fairly new but evolving area. Chris, what are nootropics?
These are products that modulate the nervous system on the whole. So they're nervous system modifying nutraceuticals effectively, and usually from the point of view of modifying mood, or modifying kind of anxiety states and things like that.
And again, sounds like a tricky regulatory area. Is it a big and expanding part of the market?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the obvious kind of elephant in the room was obviously CBD, which was the big one that kind of exploded a few years ago. I think that's probably the most famous and sort of successful nootropic kind of product.
Yeah.
But yeah, and obviously, interestingly with that, no claims could be made, but it rode on the back of people's perception that it's something to do with, you know, a particular herb, particular leaf that might have been used by some people, but is safer. You know, and THC free effectively.
Yeah.
So again, essentially, it marketed itself just because of knowledge out there. And I think the same thing can go as well for certain other botanicals, as Mike said too, that are really useful. We've got some great ones like, you know, lemon balm, holy basil, things that can have, you know, fantastic supportive effects for people.
There's also, as you say, there's a semiotics aspect to it. When you say yes. Holy balm,
holy basil,
and the word balm is balm has its it's got its own signifiers in there, as does cannabis.
I love linguistics, so it's always useful if the names kind of are indicative, and that's something to some extent we rely on, although we're still not immune from it being suggested we're trying to imply a medicinal claim. But wherever we can use those semiotics, as you say, that indication to people, giving them a sense through a name that might not be too specific of something, I think that's something that's very much come to the forefront. Imagery and naming and things has been important. And just to follow up on what Mike said, which links this as well, is I think the big mental health issue that's going to become really prominent, and it was on the news today about e-cigarettes, and that's addiction. I think addiction is the big mental health crisis. We think about depression, of course, and all of that's correct. But I think the big thing that's been there under the surface, and like a lot of things, has just been intensified by all the huge social upheavals, economically and from a COVID point of view, is addiction. And some of the, you know, socially accepted addictions, like e-cigarettes or alcohol. And in a sense, interestingly, I think CBD is that. I think to some extent, not that I'm saying that CBD is always inappropriate, but I think there was a huge groundswell of people self-medicating with CBD as something that could calm their nerves rather than smoking, rather than consuming alcohol. Of course, that could be great. But it's interesting that I think there's this concept that's running through at the moment, or maybe always, or were it ever thus through history, with use of alcohol and cigarettes and things, of people feeling the need to self-medicate against their kind of lives to make themselves feel calmer, feel better.
Yeah.
But also, I think, with what we learned earlier, although people are into that and maybe can't quite get out of it, I think there's that increasing awareness that there's something just not quite right about this, and that people will increasingly educate to look for lifestyle and nutraceutical solutions. And then I think we're into a really interesting health area of personalized mental health support, of looking at why people have certain feelings, certain anxieties, what might be there genetically, what might be going on hormonally. Lifestyle, though, is massive. What we don't want to do is get people thinking that it's always going to be something they stick in their mouth. It's also about a combination of supporting maybe those weaknesses that people definitely have, those kind of more organic biochemical things, but also looking at how that fits in with their lifestyle. And I think there's an awful lot of good that we can do as an industry through education, through the supplements that we might make, and through encouraging lifestyle changes and starting to work with others in the wider society and trying to make this perhaps a bit less elitist as a field.
Yeah. Okay. So Mike, Chris mentioned the behemoth, CBD. I don't suppose you have any stats, numbers and trends to hand about CBD, because obviously it's been a big part of the recent scene.
Yeah. I mean, but the one thing that I can say is we've looked at this over the last few years, and, you know, acceptance and understanding of what the product is slowly growing. But I think the emphasis is slowly growing. I don't think, you know, the market has grown quite in a way that was anticipated. North America still tends to lead the way in terms of, you know, the number of consumers that they have. In the UK, if I remember correctly, we our data suggests around 1 in 10 consumers have used it to some extent. And I think it goes back to exactly what Chris said. You know, CBD was seen as by the industry as this really effective solution, that it was safe, it was healthy. And consumers still see it as something that they should avoid. It's a bit of a necessary evil. It's kind of like, you know, how energy drinks were kind of seen at least historically, you know, people are going, well, I'm using this as a last resort, so therefore I should do it short term and I should stop immediately once I don't need it anymore. They were concerned about issues such as dozing, you know, like if I take CBD, can I drive my car or is that there? And I think, you know, the industry still has to come some way to overcoming these perceptions, because, you know, we have to think about consumers, about how they think. And, you know, the pressure of modern day life is overwhelming for many consumers. They don't have a work-life balance. They want to cram as many activities in as possible. They can often feel stressed. They can often feel miserable. So consumers definitely want to feel happier. They want to be open about their emotionals, but they kind of want to do that naturally through sleeping well, through spending time with family and friends. You know, there's always that thing of, should I be taking a liquid or smoking something or vaping something whereby this gives me this, especially if they associate it with chemicals, this chemical-induced form of relaxation, which...
Back to your idea of people not liking the idea that it's a chemical.
Yeah, you know, so I think the market is growing. We know that consumers are concerned about their cognitive health. They're concerned about, you know, how long they can concentrate for. They're starting to recognize things such as the influence of blue light from digital devices and what that can have on their eye health, their cognitive health in general. And consumers recognize that this is a big area. You know, if I want to stay fit and healthy until as late as life as possible, I don't just have to stay physically fit. I need to feel sharp and active, you know, for a variety of reasons. So there's definitely demand for those products. But as I said, I think, you know, the CBD market's still got some way to go. And I still think there's quite a lot of nerves around, you know, what happens next in the market.
Yeah. Now, Chris, when we last looked at CBD, the UK government was looking at its novel food regulations. Is there any recent regulations that have had any impact on the market or any changes that you've seen?
Yeah, just that, which you said, which is my understanding too. The product's kind of snuck in by the back door, or at least that's my sort of assessment of it. And then I think there was a bit of a, oh, hang on a minute, when they were being quite widely used and noticeably used.
Yeah.
Of, is this a food that we've used before? And it's actually obviously as an extract of hemp in most cases. You could argue it's hemp, or you could argue it's an extract of hemp. If it's an extract of hemp, then it potentially becomes a novel food. So there was this kind of, as I understand it, retrospective kind of process whereby effectively each product is having to go through a process of a safety dossier as a novel food would. Mm. Never quite sure why we can't do that on CBD per se, or at least the different subtypes of CBD with different ratios, but it seems to be being done on a product by product basis. However, interestingly, it was as if they couldn't pull the rug on the CBD market. I don't know, maybe there would have been people, you know, screaming in the streets or whatever. So they kept the products on the market up to a particular date that were already out there. So it's been a little bit of a strange process, not by the book.
Yeah.
And what that will mean in the long term is that it'll be harder to register a CBD product potentially. I mean, it'll have to go through this process.
Yeah.
And there probably will be fewer CBD products. That's my understanding of where it's going, that are actually approved by this process. So I think the market will, you know, compress a little bit and consolidate. My understanding and my thinking is there will still be CBD products on the UK market, but I'm not sure, but probably fewer of them and fewer different types.
Yeah, well, we'll see how that unfolds. Now, Mike, what about the economy? Not just the economy, but the economy, you know, when we're looking at a fair amount of disruption in UK political life and lots of concepts like sustainability are really up in the air at the moment. I mean, how do you see the uncertainty playing out in nutraceuticals? Very, very hard to tell, I would imagine, but go on, wave your magic wand.
The one thing that we've always got to remember is, you know, consumers have always found food inflation a genuine concern. Consumers are always juggling and struggling with their finances. There's many people, you know, who live month by month. So, you know, any downturn in the economy is going to have a significant effect. And, you know, from a consumer perspective, it shouldn't be measured necessarily on GDP performance over two quarters, you know, because consumers can be adopting recessionary style behaviors, you know, long before a recession hits, and they can continue to adopt them long after it's officially over. The one thing I would say with this is, if a product is seen as good value for money, it's got a variety of health benefits, consumers will be less price sensitive. And a good example of that at the moment is the whey protein market. We deal with a variety of whey protein companies, and we speak to their marketing departments, and they kind of joke that they're going to be out of a job soon, because the demand for whey protein is going at such a rate that actually they don't need to market the products anymore. And this is becoming, despite the you know, whey protein rising in price over the last 12 months. So as a result of this, it shows that if consumers feel it serves a genuine need today, switching for whey protein, it might be consumers outside of a core association with protein recognizing the importance of whey in their diets. It might be consumers exercising at home more because they started this during the downturn and realized the health benefits of it, and perhaps they don't need to go to the gym, they can do their CrossFit at home. For whatever reasons, you know, the whey protein market to me at the moment is showing that there is an element where products can be immune to price sensitivity if they're seen as credible, their claims are transparent, they serve genuine health need states without seeing as a magic bullet health solution. You know, I mean, don't get me wrong, you know, but there's unfortunately going to be some households where they have to choose between, you know, purchasing food or paying the energy bill. And with that, you know, obviously, unfortunately, consumers sometimes have to jeopardize on the healthiness of their diets and downtrade thinking. But, you know, for other consumers, they will be selective and engage in high-low consumerism, looking to save money in certain areas to justify spend elsewhere. And if there's a situation where consumers are really conscious about their immune health whilst being, you know, price sensitive in general, it just means that they'll be more selective in their shopping habits, which then means the right kind of innovation is needed within the nutraceutical nutritopics market, where the products that will do okay are the ones that consumers know and trust. Going back to that CBD example that we talked about before, you know, you only have to look at the retail channels. If consumers are purchasing something through a respected retailer, department store, where they feel that there's an expert behind the counter who can give some good solid advice, that will see the product potentially as good value for money. Actually, I fully understand why I'm buying this product. If they're purchasing from an independent shop on the high street where it's got a skull and wacky designs and smoke from cigarettes coming out, consumers will be less likely to trust that product and associate it with good value for money and recognize the benefit. So what will happen in the market will absolutely, consumers will become more price sensitive. That doesn't mean they'll stop buying health and wellness products, but they'll become more selective in what they purchase. So, you know, if brands can innovate, if they can develop consumer trust, they can offer maximum efficacy, they can offer maximum convenience, hey, you only need this one product because it serves a variety of need states, then consumers will continue to purchase.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So last very quick question for both of you. Actually, Mike, why didn't you start this one? You've been on a roll. What's exciting in this sector in the near future? Have you spotted anything that you think, oh, hang on, that could be interesting in the market? Some enzymes, peptides, flavonoids, and, you know, the sort of things that might crop up. Anything that has made you think, oh, hang on, here we go.
Yeah, I think the one thing that's really interesting, and it's something that, you know, may develop significantly in the next couple of years, it still might be in 10 years time, we're talking about when it develops, is the whole route down personalization and smart based technology and DNA testing.
Yeah,
that's still seen as a key area for me. You know, like we're kind of talking now about, as consumers become more health conscious, they'll be concerned that products are a bit too generic for their health needs. You'll get a generation that think, okay, this product's high in vitamin C, that's great, but actually, you know, Is this really benefiting me from a health perspective? And what do I need? And we know that consumers want information in real time. They want it personalized and they want it catered to them, you know. And DNA testing, smart-based technology that allows you to monitor things such as heart rates, illness frequency, etc., you know, your sleep health. That's, to me, the key area where we'll see the innovation and exciting. There is so many challenges. There's so much investment needed because if this isn't done effectively, the credibility of the industry will, you know, take a severe hamper. There's also a lot of ethical implications that need to be considered, you know, like what kind of information you're going to tell somebody about how their lives might play out over 30 years.
Yeah.
But I think that'll be the key area, and that's something that's very exciting.
Very good. Okay, and Chris, so you've got the last word on this. What's exciting you and what's on the horizon?
Well, I think I agree with what Mike said. I think the key thing is going to be the sophistication of consumers and all of those kind of negative dynamics we've talked about, I think, are playing out in terms of this pattern of this increased thinking, awareness, need for self-education, need to make sure they're getting value for money, and need for personalization. So health is absolutely going to be central to people's thinking. And as Mike said, their choices about how they use their money, they're going to be more careful for sure. But what we need to do is create the right sort of products that match their needs and expectations. And I think it's not particular one ingredient. I think probiotics, something called postbiotics.
I was wondering when postbiotics would come.
Postbiotics being dead probiotics, or they're sometimes called zombiotics, the idea that the bacteria don't need to be alive.
I've never heard of zombiotics. That's brilliant. Brilliant.
I think I can't trademark that one. I'm pretty sure someone's used it before. But it's the idea that it's either the dead bacteria and the impact they have on the immune system, or even sometimes the live bacteria. It's not the live bacteria itself, but it's the metabolites. And I think there's all sorts of interesting things in terms of, you know, the microbiome and how we personalize that, but also combining that with the genetics, you know, the characteristics of the microbiome, the characteristics of genetics, the characteristics of your lifestyle choices, you can really shape what's going to work for a person. So I completely agree with Mike that I think there's this amalgamation as part of that sophistication that's going on of testing, advice, and nutraceuticals. And I think the industry is going to merge much more closely together into more one-stop shop solutions where people want to know, you know, what is it about me and what is it about these products that help me understand it? A, so I choose the right ones, and B, so I get that value for money. This is still potentially going to be expensive to support my health, but how can I do it in a way that's more specific, more accurate, and more personalized to me? And then they'll hopefully see the value. I think also in terms of just coming back to ingredients, it's more about, for me now, looking at what we've already got and re-engineering them in better ways to make sure the products are as good as possible, as sustainable as possible as well, and offer that value to people that they're going to work. So it's about formulation, and it's about brands, I think, really thinking about how they put things together. Because the novel food environment does make it very difficult for us to innovate. But what we need to do is rework to some extent what we've already got. And I think so much has changed in the last 5 years that that's the real challenge for the nutraceutical industry, to get these better products and to match them to people and give people the right education, information and support to make sure they're getting the right product that's going to genuinely create a healthier situation for them.
Well, that's absolutely fantastic. There's a huge amount of information there. So let's check in again soon to find out how it's all unfolding. Mike Hughes and Chris Newbold, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. And remember, if you enjoyed the Food Matters Live podcast, you can subscribe on your preferred platform so you never miss an episode. And if you feel inclined, go on, why don't you leave us a review? Thank you so much for listening.